The topic for the evening is charging for medical services. I've used a couple of different titles in the run-up to this, and frankly, the titles have changed based on the topics that people were interested in, so that the more feedback I got, the more my list of questions was modified, and the more angled it became towards nuances in charging for healthcare, what exactly one may charge for, why may one charge, how insistent may one be in a charging for healthcare, what about refusing to provide services without being paid, and charging for care on Shabbos. So we have many issues, so much so that I know I'm not going to get to what really was one of my favorites going in, which was the question of whether a physician is allowed to approve a service for OHIP coverage if the service doesn't fit OHIP's standard. It's one of my favorites because on the one hand you'd think, well, no, obviously you can't, and on the other hand it happens, and I've seen it happen routinely. So you know, that's something that we'll have to discuss at some point in some class, but because there are so many other things we need to get to that people have asked about, that one's not going to end up being on the list of things that we reach tonight. We begin with the question of what justifies charging for healthcare at all? What justifies a physician saying, I want to be paid for healing? And we will have nuances in terms of what the services are that we're talking about. But right now, we're going to stipulate that what we're talking about is providing healing for somebody who is in need of healing. Okay, as opposed to some of the other types of services that that come up. So the first question you have to ask then is, well, why not charge for healthcare? Right? If I am asking the question of what justifies it, why would I think that one would not be justified in charging for healthcare? What would you say? It's a mitzvah to save someone's life, and therefore what? It's an obligation for me to do it. Not just that it's a good thing to do, but it's actually obligatory. So I don't have the right to say to somebody, you have to pay me in order to get me to do it, when it's something that I'm actually obligated to do anyway.
Even if it's a private doctor, if it's belonged to or him or something like that.
Right. So we are going to get into nuances of socialized medicine as part of the discussion. But right now I'm actually going to ask the question either way. Whether the person I am charging is the patient, or whether the, so to speak, person I am charging is the government of Ontario, at the end of the day, I am saying I will not do this mitzvah unless someone puts money in my wallet. And so the question is, am I allowed to do that? That's our first step question. If you take a look on your sheet, it starts number one. And I tried really hard this time to cut down on the sources that I was going to put on the sheet. I'm going to go with Mike. But I tried to cut down on the number of sources that would be on the sheet in the interest of getting through everything that we have to get through, because otherwise this would be about 2.5 times longer, the source sheets. But this is a Mishnah in Nedarim. So we're talking about a text in the Talmud going back 2,000 years. And it says, Hamudar hana'a mechaveiro. If someone is not allowed to benefit somebody else, because a vow was taken that Reuven is not going to provide any benefit to Shimon, whether because Reuven said, I don't want to benefit Shimon, or Shimon said, I don't want anything from Reuven. The circumstances will not matter for us, for our purposes. Mirapehu refuas nefesh, avalo refuas mamon. So he is allowed to heal the person. Even though he's not supposed to be providing that person with benefit, nonetheless he's allowed to heal him. He can't heal his property. The guy has a sick cow, he can't take care of the cow. But he is allowed to take care of the person himself. And the reason why he's allowed to take care of the person himself is because he is what we call in the Talmud, mushpa ve'omed mehar Sinai. He has already sworn at Mount Sinai to take care of other people's health. In other words, as a Jew, he has an obligation to provide whatever assistance he can in preserving the health of others. So you can't take a vow, just like I'm not allowed to take a vow that says, I will not eat matzah on Pesach night, or a vow that I'm going to steal an object from somebody, I can't take a vow that I'm not going to provide health care. I would be working against that which I've already agreed to do. Ellen. True. But I think that's because of consistency of language. The context here for this Mishnah, this thought in itself and the surrounding ones, is a discussion in general of what one may do even if he has taken a vow not to, or someone has taken a vow not to benefit from him. So it talks about visiting the person, it talks about teaching his children, it talks about all sorts of different actions, and it's consistently a language of he may do this, he may do this, he may do this, without distinguishing between those things which he really ought to be doing because it's his obligation, and things which are simply permissible to him. But it's a good point. The language does lead someone in that direction.
We say normally that kol melacha needs maskoret. Okay, the doctor or any other profession, they want to school, they learn the trade and everything. They cannot work for free, just for the name of the mitzvah, because they have to get some money if it's private or if it's through him. And this is the even my money when he took care of the son of the king. He got paid.
Oh, you better believe it. It's true. There was a rather testy letter sent to him. Not from a patient. When Maimonides took a stance against accepting money for studying Torah, against the Kollel system, so the response of the Tashbetz generations later, Rabbi Shimshon ben Tzemach Duran, was, you know, not everybody had this sinecure where they could, be paid to work for the Sultan. So yes, he absolutely was paid. That's 100% true. Although he also did, I believe, do considerable pro bono work. But that's not the point. The point is that yes, what you're saying is true, and yes, we have to come to that, because that has to be part of the discussion. There was a hand over here.
Could you also ask the same question of Mohalim, Melamdim,
You bet. We are going to come to the case of the Moel, and we are going to come to the case of the teacher. So both of those are going to be part of this conversation, absolutely. So what we've established here is that one is not allowed, or not one is not allowed, one is not able to take a vow not to heal somebody because it is a mitzvah. What mitzvah is it? It could be the mitzvah of Vashevo Tolo, which says that if someone has lost something, you are responsible to restore it to that person. It could be the mitzvah of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by as the blood of your brother is shed. It could be the mitzvah of Achecha Imach, make sure that your brother can live with you. There are various sources suggested. We've discussed it in other sessions. But it clearly is a mitzvah, and therefore, if you take a look at source number 2, from the Shulchan Aruch, the 16th century code of Jewish law, Nasna Torah Rishus L'Rofei L'Rabos, it notes that the Gemara says, as we discussed on other occasions, that the Torah licenses physicians to heal, lest anyone think physicians should not heal. Whether because you think that illness comes from God and therefore you're working against God, or whether because healing necessarily involves certain risks, treatments don't always work, sometimes they have negative results. Nonetheless, we are told physicians are licensed to heal, and therefore, the Shulchan Aruch writes, U-mitzvahi, it is not only something you are permitted to do, it is a mitzvah, u-bichlal pikuach nefeshu, it's part of saving lives. And if one refrains, hareza shofech damim. One who would refrain would be guilty of shedding blood. So that sounds pretty strong. Now, mind you, that seems to be talking about life-saving care. We may need to distinguish. But the point is, this seems to be a clear-cut obligation. And once we say it's an obligation, we may indeed say, therefore, you can't charge. Not just for the logical reason we suggested a couple of minutes ago, when we said, well, if you're obligated to do it, how can you charge people money for it? But also because of a biblical verse. If you take a look at source number 3, the Gemara in Becharot, the Talmud says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Rav Yehuda says, quoting Rav, there is a verse in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, in which Moshe turns to the Jews, and he says, Re'ei limadati eschem, see, I have taught you, as God instructed me. That's the extension in the verse. I taught you, Moshe says to the Jews, as God taught me, as God instructed me to teach, and now you have to turn around and pass it on to the next generation. And the Talmud says, Ma'ani b'chinam, just like I, Moshe, taught you for free, no one's paying Moshe. There is a passage in the Talmud that says that he got the pieces that he chiseled out of the second set of tablets that he brought down from Sinai. But that's not payment for his work in teaching the Jews for the ensuing 39 years. But just as I taught you for free, avatem b'chinam, so you must teach for free. I taught for free, therefore you have to teach for free. And the understanding is, because it is his mitzvah, because God told him to do this, therefore he had to do it for free, and that's the way it should continue to be done, and that seems to be extended to healthcare. If you take a look at source number 4, again from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law from the 16th century, Harofe, the doctor, Asur Litol Schar HaChochma BaHalimud. The doctor is not allowed to take payment for knowledge and teaching. Knowledge and teaching means giving instruction to the patient. So in other words, the doctor is sitting at home, or the doctor is sitting on a bus, the doctor is sitting in shul, right? And the doctors will, you know, be nodding their heads like, yeah, I know what that happens. And someone comes over to the doctor and says, listen, you know, my kid is on his third day of a fever, and he has some kind of stomach problem and a lot of pain in his throat. What do you think? Should I be starting him on penicillin? You know, then the doctor may say, and this is not medical advice, and the doctor sitting there may say, yeah, I think it's probably a good idea to start on penicillin, and then Sunday may send a bill. So that last part I know doesn't really happen.
The doctor cannot treat without seeing a patient.
Right. No, that wasn't medical advice, and that's not the precise scenario. The point is, where the doctor does nothing other than offer advice, there was no strain on the doctor's part because the doctor was just sitting there. They didn't have to go look things up. They didn't have to run tests. They simply gave advice. They had knowledge in their head, and they conveyed it to the person. So in such a case, he says, you can't charge. Aval, however, draws an interesting distinction. Schar ha-Torah v'abatala mutar. Payment for strain, if you have to go work, if you have to, you know, go to where the patient is, or if you have to go look things up, or we'll see what else might be included within strain, as well as batala, the loss of one's time. I wasn't necessarily planning on being a physician today. I was going to drive a cab. I was going to go do something else. The payment for the time lost from another pursuit, mutar, that the doctor may charge for. That's what the Shulchan Aruch writes, and the Rav Gedalia Rabinovich, in an article in a work called Halacha Refuah, which is an anthology of articles on medical care and Jewish law, says that the reason why you're allowed to charge for these latter items, for strain, as well as for time lost from other pursuits, is because those are part of the essential mitzvah. The essential mitzvah is heal people. If you're going to need to go beyond, if you're going to need to strain yourself in order to do it, that wasn't part of your requirement, and therefore you are allowed to claim for that. That you're allowed to recoup your expenses for. But other than that, no payment. Now that's surprising. And the reason it's surprising is because we have sources in Torah and Talmud that seem to assume a greater wage for physicians. For example, the most obvious and easy example, the biblical text from which we learn that there is such a thing as a license to heal within Judaism is the case in which one person hits somebody else and wounds that other party, and we say that the attacker, the assailant, is required to hire somebody to heal his victim. That's how we know there is such a thing. But it says, you have to pay for him. Right? Rakshiv to yitain, he shall pay for his time lost from work. Virapo yirapay, and he shall heal him, which we understand to mean hiring a doctor. Further, if you take a look at source number 5, we get the kind of humorous case in which the assailant says, listen, my cousin's a doctor. He'll do me a favor. He'll heal you for free. Does the victim have to accept that? So take a look. The Iomar Lay, if the assailant says to his victim, Maisina Asya Demagin Bemagan, I'm going to bring you a doctor who's going to cure you for nothing. Omar Lay, the victim may respond, Asya Demagin Bemagan Magan Shaveh. A doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. In other words, the assumption is there's charging going on. Could you say that this is just talking about time lost from other pursuits and strain? You could if you had to, but it would be a forced answer. There generally are other resolutions for this. Specifically, there are two main approaches to this. Before I give the two main approaches to this, there are two apparently simple ideas that we could suggest, and some do suggest, but don't seem to have traction within Jewish law. I bring them just because they're sort of obvious approaches. One approach is to say, yes, it's true that we have this idea that we brought in source number 3, that just as Moshe taught for free, the Jews should teach for free. And therefore, I would think any mitzvah you do should be for free. However, once I have a biblical verse that says, you shall pay for healing, it's what we call a gzeres hakasuv. It's a decree of the text. It says you're allowed to charge. And that overrides what we saw regarding teaching. And there is such an idea, but again, it doesn't seem to have traction within the sources of halacha, of Jewish law. The Tosfos HaRosh brings it on the Gemara in Brachos Tav Samach. The second idea would be to say, source number 3, from which we understood mitzvah would have to be done for free, was talking about Talmud Torah, was talking about teaching Torah. Maybe it doesn't apply beyond teaching Torah. Maybe that just applies to teaching Torah. Maybe it doesn't apply to all mitzvot. Why do you assume that I have to extrapolate from it? In fact, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, a great rabbi in Israel from 100 to 150 years ago, wrote in the commentary to the Rambam that, in fact, you can see it in the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah in Nedarim, this idea that it's specifically teaching that has to be done for free. Nonetheless, the trend in halacha, as seen in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, is not to follow that position, but in fact to say that that this does apply to healing. So how do I understand it? So again, there are two main approaches. One approach is to say we can only pay schar batala, schar tircha. You can only pay for time lost and for strain. If you take a look at source number 6, Ramban Nachmanides, himself reported to have been a physician, writing in 13th century Spain, says, Ulenyan schar refua, as far as payment for healing, nirali demutarli tol mehen schar batala v'tircha. It appears to me you can take payment for strain and for time lost, aval schar limud asur, but you're not allowed to take payment for conveying information. That's what he says. And that, by the way, Ramban, remember, Nachmanides is 13th century. That is the text that is the basis for what we saw in the early 16th in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. This is the line of tradition here. Ramban is saying it, and it is accepted by the Shulchan Aruch. He says that's the way it works, is that you can only get schar batala, schar tircha. That's all that one would be allowed to be paid for. Now, I said before, you have to define what payment for strain means. What constitutes strain? Take a look at this surprising source. Source number 7. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in Novardok, early 20th century Lithuania, in his Aruch HaShulchan Code of Law. Kishikosev lola beis harokeach liten kach v'kach, when he writes to the pharmacy, saying, give whatever it is to the patient, havischar tircha umutar, you could take payment for writing a prescription, for whatever strain is involved in writing a prescription. Right. Well, especially when you're talking about Lithuania of 130 years ago. You know, I don't know what sort of pen he's using, but I wager that it's a less simple system than the keyboard we can use now.
You must be kidding.
Sorry?
You You must be kidding. We just changed to an EMR. It is not
EMR. Right, that's fair. EMR may be a whole other type of tircha. That's definitely true. And Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, in a response in Chelek Hei Chavdal, it actually challenges this idea of Yor HaShoham that we could say you could charge for the prescription. But it's an interesting possibility. However, the more salient point, which we're going to come back to, because it's a major point, is this issue of Schar Batala, time lost from other pursuits. In a time when people did all sorts of things for a living, and one thing they did was healing, but they had many other pursuits at the same time. They may have been a barber, right, when you think about the barber bloodletter, or they may have been a plumber, or whatever it is. So you could say, I'm taking my time from these other things in order to heal you. You have to pay me for what I could have earned doing whatever. But in our age, that tends not to be the case. You know, unless you're talking about somebody who maybe is a paramedic for a few hours a week with an ambulance crew. But generally speaking, doctors are doctors and that's what they do. That's their trade. They're not doing something else. So how do I now identify schar batala, time lost from other things for them? Effectively, for them, becoming physicians means that they are now taking all of their time away from other pursuits in order to do this. And lest the patients say, well, I don't need all of their time. I just need 11 to 11:30 on Tuesday morning, right? That's my appointment. And as far as I'm concerned, they can fish during the rest of the time. It doesn't work that way, because then this person wouldn't be available to be your doctor. So therefore, we have to regrade what Ramban is talking about for our day, when physician is a full-time job. Take a look at source number 8, where that work has already been done for us. Remember that the Gemara in Bechor wrote, that I quoted you in source number 3, the passage out of the Talmud, said that one has to teach for free. The context for that statement is actually talking about judges. And a statement in the Talmud that if a judge takes payment for his rulings, then his judgments are worthless. We throw them out. Not allowed to take payment for it. So Tosfot, writing in 12th, 13th century, says, well, you know that in Jerusalem, going back to Talmudic times and earlier, you had judges, and that was their job. And of course they got paid. They were paid not by the litigants, but they were paid by the community. How did they take payment? So he writes, the Ein Lismoa, he says, do not be surprised by the judges of Jerusalem. They were paid from the temple collection. The half shekel donation that everybody made went in part for them. He says, aside from the point about being paid for time lost when they're actually working, further, since their entire involvement, all of their business was sitting in court, hearing cases, and they didn't do any upwork, like the point that was made before. They needed some way to make a living. So what Tosfos says here, and again, it's a comment we're going to come back to, is they need to get schar batala for the time of their actual work. But more globally, you have to pay them for the fact that this is what they're devoting their lives to. That is the new definition of schar batala. So that even though one approach to our problem, again, let's remember where we've been. We noted that there's a mitzvah of healing. We noted that the Talmud says that those who teach must teach for free. And we extended that to healing and say, if you're going to do the mitzvah of healing, you have to heal for free. But we saw sources that said that physicians are charging. So Ramban's approach is to say they can charge for their time loss. They can charge for their strain. That school may well end up saying a full-time physician is able to charge whatever he needs to survive in order to be able to devote his life to medical work, whatever that number is.
Today's existing that. If you have an appointment with the doctor and you don't cancel like 2 days before, okay, that love star that the doctor, it's a batala, and you have to pay the doctor the...
Yes, and as long as that condition is stated up front, that's 100% legitimate in Jewish law. Yep. Adina, you were going to say?
I was going to ask, what does that mean? You can charge just what you need to, like, put food on your table, or you can charge whatever the market rate is?
So I think it would be based on being able to live normally, whatever the normal standard of people's lives, not putting food on the table, but... You look at the community, and you look what people need in order to be able to send their kids to school and to have new clothing for Yom Tov, and whatever it is, even though not everybody can reach that, not everybody can do that, it's legitimate for the doctor to say, that's what I want for my life. It doesn't mean that it's what everybody can do. It means that's what people would objectively look at and say, that's a healthy living standard. Now, again, that's one approach.
Is it not taken literally? Charged to teach other medical students or whatever. I mean, that's a literal translation of what this is. So, you know, if you took medical clinics and you had students with you, whatever, and you didn't charge for that, I mean, that's how I would have interpreted it. But you're interpreting it more in terms of the actual treatment of the patient.
Right, only because that's the context in which it's stated. I agree with you 100%, and there actually is an author, I referenced it within my notes, I think it was Reb Chaim David HaLevi in an article in the journal Torah Baal Peh, who actually seems to think that Schar Limud does mean something different. If I remember correctly, he actually thinks it means payment that is reimbursable to the doctor for what he had to pay in tuition in order to learn to become a doctor. Which, frankly, to me, was the intuitive way to read the line. That was my gut when I read the line. However, it seems clear in Ramban, in source number 6, that he's talking about something you are doing for the patient. So it could be charging the patient for my student loans, which went into being able to heal him. And it could be, as we say, teaching the patient. But it would be hard to say it's talking suddenly in the middle of a line about a different context and teaching other doctors or teaching medical students. I would have a hard time seeing that in this sentence. The other approach, aside from Ramban's approach, is to say no. Doctors are indeed entitled to accept payment beyond strain and time lost, and for 4 reasons. Reason number 1 is because doctors deal in a high-risk situation. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing from Krakow in the early 16th century, provides an Ashkenazi element to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. And what he says, I'm going to say it outside of the text, even though I brought you the text, just because the text is hard to understand without added elements. You're talking about witnesses who sign on a bill of divorce. Okay, remember that within Jewish law, documents generally that memorialize events are signed not by the participants in the events, but by the witnesses. So, the witnesses are supposed to sign on this document. What if they mess something up? Well, you know, documents are expensive. You have to go to the sofer, you have to go to the scribe, and he has to write something new with new materials. You're paying for his time. You may have a case in which you need to pay the Beit Din for their time. I don't know the circumstances and how they did it then. But the point is, there are expenses involved. What if you get a witness who botches the document when he signs his name? So, Rabbi Israelis writes that some say you're allowed to stipulate that the witnesses, if they ruin the get, are going to need to pay. Well, if you ask me then to be a witness on a get, you know what I'm going to say. Ask someone else. So in response to that, the witness is able to charge for being a witness and say, it's like insurance, right? You're going to pay me to do this work, and in the event that I do badly, then I'm going to need to pay you. So Rabbi Isserles suggests within this line that there's a justification for witnesses getting large amounts of money for serving as a witness. And the justification is because they would have to pay out larger sums of money if they did something wrong. And that idea is brought by Rav Shaul Yisraeli in his Hatarava HaMedina, as well as Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham and his Nishmas Avram Yerodeya Shalom Mitvav Yud Gimel, they say that doctors are in a high-risk situation. Because if they botch something, they are going to find themselves in trouble. Granted, there is insurance. Premiums will go up. Problems can still start. Therefore, doctors are justified in claiming payment for that reason. That's number one. Number two, a fascinating philosophical point worthy of its own session, really. By Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller in source number 10. He argues, in 15th century Germany, he says, Kishakovin oso lios kavua ladun, ze eno bichlal ha-mitzvah. He says, he's talking about judges in context. He's not talking about doctors. But he says, if you become a permanent judge, you are no longer engaged in a mitzvah of judging. It's your job. It's no longer about the mitzvah anymore. Now, I am not at all clear on how this works. Why does it stop being a mitzvah just because you're doing it in a permanent way? Except that his point is, as he spells out, you don't have discretion of, I want to treat this one, I don't want to treat that one. Or today I'm going to be off, and tomorrow I'm going to do it. Whoever shows up that day is your responsibility. And because of that, it's no longer viewed as a mitzvah such that you wouldn't be allowed to take wages. And Rishol Yisraeli in his Atarah Bahamadina says the same is true. If you're appointed as a community physician and you have no choice about accepting patients, we don't look at it as a mitzvah. We look at it as, this is what I'm doing for a living. And therefore, you are indeed allowed to be paid for it. Again, I'm not sure why it's no longer a mitzvah. I'm not sold on this. I don't quite understand it. Yeah. But why would that be true?
Because you're not beholden to whoever's paying you. You know, the reality is, if somebody's employing you on a permanent basis and it's your livelihood, you're more likely to, you know, possibly be swayed or whatever, you know, that's where it stops being a mitzvah, that you're not.
But I'm confused. I mean, if healing people is a mitzvah, wouldn't signing on to do it all the time be a greater mitzvah? I don't know. I'm not clear on what Tosas Yom Tov is suggesting. Yeah.
I'm thinking of a scenario where if I volunteer to lead services, or if I'm a chido for daily services, for me it's a mitzvah. I don't expect to get paid. Nobody's going to pay me. But if you want to hire a chazan and say it's a mitzvah, you have the opportunity to do this 7 days a week, maybe 21 times. It may not be that it's no longer a mitzvah, it's just in a different category. It's a mitzvah and there are other considerations. Because I imagine the chazan is doing a mitzvah when he leads us in services.
We're going to talk about the chazan. We're not there yet. We're going to talk about the chazan when we get to talking, when we talk about payment for Shabbos.
If Jeff doesn't show up for your prayer meeting, no one's going to say, so there's somebody else.
I want to go further because there is a ton of material to cover, but it's worth thinking about. Third, and frankly, you know, most obvious, I would think, until we find out, until we look into it, is people can agree to whatever terms they want. In other words, you may tell me that I can only charge for my strain and my time lost. And I can then say, okay, then I'm not interested in being a physician. You want me to be a physician? Here are my services that I provide, and here are my fees. And if you don't like it, go to somebody else. And if they agree, they sign on the dotted line and say, okay, we want you to be the one to do whatever it is, then they've agreed to my fees. It's simply, you know, it's an agreement. If you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi David Halevi wrote the Taz commentary, to Reza Hab commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, early 17th century Poland. And he wrote, Kevan shekvar hisna imo v'ischayev negdo chayev l'shalem. Since he already stipulated it, doctor and patient already came up with their agreement, the patient obligated himself to pay, he has to pay. It's not as though this doctor is the only person on earth who's obligated in the mitzvah of healing. Anybody could train and become a physician. No one said that it had to be this fellow. So the argument is, free market, I can charge. They could say yes, they could say no. The argument against this comes from source number 12. Take a look at source number 12. Hareshaya Boreach Mibeit HaAsirin. Somebody is fleeing imprisonment. Vaisama Vores Lefanav. There's a river in front of him. He needs the ferry to cross the river. Amarlo told Dinar Vahavi Reini. So he says to the person running the ferry, listen, take this dinar, which is a significant coin, more than normally one pays for the ferry. He says, listen, take the dinar, take me across the river. Then he gets to the other side and says, I don't want to give you a dinar. I just needed to get away. The person who runs the ferry can only get whatever the standard wage is for a river crossing. Alma, Amar, and that's the quote, that's the source that the Talmud is discussing, and the Talmud comments on that source, Alma, Amar, Le, Mishanta, Ani, Bach. That means that you're allowed to say to somebody, I was just fooling you. I was saying this because I needed to say it, because otherwise you wouldn't have taken me across the river. I was over a barrel, so I agreed to it when I was stuck. So the challenge is, why couldn't the patient say, I needed heart surgery. I needed fill in the blank, whatever it was that I needed. I agreed to pay because I needed this, but it's an impossible fee you're demanding. I'll pay you whatever is the normal fee, whatever that means, however you determine that. But I can't pay you this amount, and I shouldn't be obligated to pay you this amount. That's the potential argument. However, you need to look at it with greater sophistication. What's the rationale for not needing to pay the ferry driver?
Because he may not have a special skill, and that there's a standard rate, and that any ferry driver could do the same thing, whereas if you're dealing with a doctor, not every doctor may be able surgery.
Right. So there are multiple points within that. I want to grab one of them for now, which is, there's a standard rate. There's a standard rate for ferry drivers, and it's not a dinar. So look at what Ramban does with this in source 13. Ramban, before the part that I excerpted, says, it's not about there being a mitzvah of saving this person. That's not what the issue is. And he now explains what the issue really is. He says, he says, when you're dealing with a ferryman, there's a fee. There's a known fee. The sign says what the fee is. Half a shekel, whatever it is. And instead, you promised him a dinar, you only have to pay the half a shekel. However, when you're dealing with a doctor, you have to pay whatever it is you stipulated, because the doctor is providing you with wisdom. The doctor, through knowledge of the condition, through knowledge of diagnosis, through knowledge of medicine, is able to convey to you what you need to do in order to get better. He says, you can't put a dollar amount on that. It's priceless, as Ramban puts it. Yeah?
Didn't you say originally that you can't charge for that?
So, what Ramban is now saying, you're right. What Ramban now seems to be saying is that if somebody agreed to it, which is the key, this person agreed to it. And if you look at the ferry case, he actually volunteered it. Right? If he agreed to it, it could be the doctor should not have asked for it. That's entirely possible within what Ramban said before. But if the patient said, I'm going to pay you this, he can't later claim that was just an unrealistic promise that I made because I was desperate for you to treat me. Because there's no such thing as unrealistic.
But does that give the doctor the right to charge?
No, but it gives the patient the obligation to pay it. We're going to come back to that dichotomy later. This is not the last time we're going to see that.
What if the patient in that scenario feels that he's under duress? I'm sick, I'm going to die, you're the only doctor in this small town. You come to see me, you can provide the service, I'll pay you whatever, and then I'm going to go to some authority and ask for part of my money back because you've charged me an exorbitant amount. How would that be viewed under Jewish law?
Good. So we have to. That's exactly what we have to ask. The First of all, just, I think I brought on it. No, I didn't bring it on here. Never mind. But there are at least three limitations on what the doctor can do based on what we said. Number one, Rabbi Gedalia Rabinovich notes in his article on Halacha Refuah that if it's dangerous care meaning not dangerous care, if the person is suffering from a dangerous condition, then you don't have the right to make conditions. Then it's more analogous to the fellow who's fleeing, whose life is in danger, and he can legitimately say, I was willing to say anything because I was absolutely desperate. Number two, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in his Tzitz Eliezer in his fifth volume, as well as Rabbi J. David Bleich in an article in Tradition, which I actually gave you a link for later on, it's verse 22. But Rabbi Bleich notes as well, and so is implied in Ramban, in the case where there's only one doctor in town, then once again, the patient can say, I was desperate and I only agreed because I had no other options. And the mitzvah was your mitzvah, specifically, because there is no one else around who can treat. And then the third limitation would be, if the customer, the client, the patient, gave some indication in advance that he didn't intend to pay, and that this was just stated in order to get the doctor to agree. So if he gave any indication of discomfort with it, of, I don't want to pay this, then yes, he could come back later and say, I never really agreed to do it. So the limitations are there.
But today you have a question like kidney transplant. They go outside the country to buy the kidney.
Right.
And they have to pay up front.
Yeah. So then this won't apply.
Huh?
This won't apply because you know you're not getting your money back. Right. Then this, right. Whether that's right to ought to do is another story, but you are correct.
And even a doctor who has to do a cardiac transplant, like you said, is not only one person, it's a group of people they're going to work on that patient.
Yes.
That's when the amount of aid is going to be increased by multiplied by the number of people.
Correct.
Is it not
correct?
Just a mitzvah whatsoever.
I'm a little bit confused because in 13 it says if you have to pay it. If you say you're going to pay it, you offer it, you have to pay it. But then you're saying that if there's conditions where you don't have to pay it.
Right, because I brought you only a piece of the Ramban. I didn't bring you his full comment, which includes his point that the mitzvah is on all doctors. He didn't have to be the one who was going to take care of this case. And also, I believe he stated as well, take a look at my notes quickly, I believe Ramban himself stated that this is not a case of, in terms of healing, if it's not a case, maybe, I'm not sure whether he said, I have to go back and look in Ramban to see whether he mentioned the point also about it not necessarily being a life and death case for the doctor. I'm not sure whether he said that or whether that was something that others had added in, but he definitely made the point of the mitzvah being for all doctors to do, and not just for him. And therefore, if there's only one doctor, then Ramban will accept the limitation. In terms of the limitation of where the patient gave an indication that he didn't want to pay this, that is just logical. Since your whole point is, where you stipulated he's going to do it, he has to do it, if the patient showed that he wasn't really making such a stipulation, then he won't have to do it.
So then it wouldn't fit into that he stipulated that he...
Correct. He wouldn't fit this case, that's all. It's just a logical exclusion. Again, make sure we know where we are with this, because this is the biggest part of the shiur, and you don't want to lose this. It'll affect everything we do from here on out. So, we pointed to the problem. The problem being, it's a mitzvah, and like teaching, it should be free. We pointed to, on the other hand, sources that indicate doctors are getting paid. One type of resolution I threw out, because I said it doesn't seem to be quoted as halacha. The second type of resolution was Ramban's approach, which was that you could charge for time lost and strain, which we pointed out in the case of a full-time physician may basically be a standard living, and you have to contribute to that. The third approach is you can accept payment beyond tircha, batala, and strain and time lost, either because the doctor deals in a high-risk situation or because the doctor has to take everybody and it's not a mitzvah, or because people can agree to whatever terms they want, notwithstanding the ferry. And then the last possibility, the last point I want to make in this, is Rabbi Gedalia Rabinovich notes, society has a compelling interest in having doctors get paid. Because if you don't pay your doctors, you will not have doctors. You take a look at source number 14. Rabbi Rabinovich says, Misha rotza liyos rofe, if someone wants to be a doctor, muchrach ulashkia harbe shnot yegiya ve'amal, he has to invest many years of work. And he also has to invest in great wealth for tuition. So if society is going to say we don't pay the doctors, society will not have doctors. People aren't going to invest this way to become physicians. It's as simple as that. It's society's compelling interest, notwithstanding the idea that they should be paying for, that they should be doing their mitzvah. Okay. So, in a setting like Ontario, in which you have a socialized system, and the hardest part of this year for me was going on the various OHIP-related websites to understand blended capitation and all these other systems for payment. But how much would a physician be allowed to charge? Well, if you're dealing with care that is needed for people's lives, and I'm lumping together literal life and death, ER, you know, the person, you know, they had a stroke, whatever type of a scenario, along with care that's needed for the upkeep of somebody's health, you know, say a diabetic, that kind of thing, who may not be in a life and death circumstance right now, but if they're not taken care of on an ongoing basis, they will be. So, it depends on which authority you take. It could be limited to time lost from other pursuits and strain, which may turn out to be a full-time physician's salary anyway, as we said. Or you take the other view that there's justification for it to take more. But it's very clear that they can end up charging, certainly if they're a full-time physician, they can end up charging what is needed. Now, in a socialized system, there are nuances which we have to get to. For discretionary care, so then it would be anything that is specified from the start. As long as you specify it from the start, it should be okay for you to charge it. Again, assuming that you're not the only physician in town, and assuming that the person doesn't indicate that they're not planning on paying. What about non-medical activities? You know, filling in the kids' immunization forms and sending a letter to the camp or whatever it is that they need to do. So it seems to me that anything that they specify from the start would be 100% acceptable. Maharam Shik wrote a responsum on this going back a couple of hundred years regarding taking payment for writing a death certificate. Right, that doesn't count as an act of healing. And he said physicians allowed to take payment for writing a death certificate. It's just like any other service that one person provides for another. So you want to charge for it. It's not even an act of healing. It's not a mitzvah act. It's simply, I have certain skills that enable me to do this. You need it? Okay, so pay me for the time that I'm going to put into it. That's really what it comes down to, and it seems to be acceptable. I did have one side question that came into this discussion, which I included here on the sheet. Take a look at source 15. Article by Dr. Fred Rosner from 1993. The article is really about the physician strikes, which we're going to come back to, God willing. But he asks, if it's a mitzvah that the doctor is expected to participate in, does that mean that physicians are obligated always to be available for their patients? Do you have to be round the clock? Someone calls you at 3 a.m. and you're drowsy, and they say, but it's your mitzvah, right? Try it. And he writes, this question requires additional deliberation and consultation with competent rabbinic authorities. He's not sure. He's a doctor, and a rather accomplished one. And he's not sure. So I think there are three grounds that may be presented for justifying the physician's break time and vacation time. Number one, the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg, in his Tzitz Eliezer, it's Yud Tes Samach Gimel, points out that even though we were very harsh in our formulation, we said that if a doctor doesn't heal, he's guilty of bloodshed and so on, there actually is no penalty in Jewish law for failing to fulfill lo tamod al dam reyecha, the law that says do not stand by. If a person stands by, there is actually no penalty. So that's point number one. Point number two, I'm not the one who noted that. Someone else I read noted that. Point number two, there's a lot of discussion in employment law, within the context of Jewish law in general, about what an employee's responsibility is to his employer. Pesachei Choshen, Blau, in volume 4, Perek Zion, has discussion of this. I sign on to do a job. Pick a job, any job, it doesn't make a difference. I sign on that I am going to lug barrels at the docks. Am I allowed to take a job at night which is going to weaken my ability to do my job in the morning on the docks? The answer is no. I'm not allowed to. When I sign on for that job as a porter, I'm not simply saying I'm going to be there from this time to this time in whatever condition I'm in. I'm signing that I am going to be able to do the job for which I was hired. And I'm certainly not allowed to put myself in a position where I can't do that. So I'm now going to extrapolate from that point to the doctor and say that if you have a doctor who is going to be working 24/7, available all the time for people, that person's not going to be a good doctor. They're going to burn out. It's only a question of how long it's going to take, and they're going to make mistakes. So you don't want to do this to your physician. It's not in the interests of serving the health of the community and fulfilling this mitzvah. That's the second point. And then the third point, which Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham points out from Rav Eliashiv. If you take a look at source 16, he's not the only doctor. There are other doctors around. So he writes, and in the interest of time, I'm actually not going to read it inside. But he quotes from Rabbi Eliashiv that as long as there are other doctors around, and it's not urgent, like they need to go to me, they don't have time to find somebody else. So if there's a time that I need, it's my break time. That's my break time. You can't ask me to do it. Clear? Thanks. Okay. So a question was put to me. What would Judaism say of a socialized system of reimbursement for physicians? Now that we've said that the physician may charge in one form or another, what about a socialized system? So the answer seems to be that it would be good to offer doctors as much money as possible. That would be a good thing, because society needs physicians. We've discussed this any number of times. It would make sense to provide an incentive for people to become physicians. Further, people are supposed to want to pay physicians. If you take a look at Source 17, Rabbi Moshe Alevi Steinberg, in an article that deals primarily with strikes, he envisions a beautiful world in which there's no need for strikes, in which doctors underclaim what they want for their wages. They claim less than they should really get. And the community should recognize that it has a need for these physicians and then offer more. It's an ideal world. It's a utopia of some kind. Maybe it existed in 1983, but I don't think so. But he says that would be the way to do things. People should want to pay. And therefore, you should be able to just say, we don't need a socialized system. Let the doctors say what they want, and then we'll pay it. Or in a socialized system, we'll pay whatever they ask. However, as I brought in source number 18, the Talmud does say, Rashon b'nei ha'ir lahasnos alamidos v'ala sha'arim v'al scharpolim u'lahasiyah al kitzasan. Townspeople are allowed to make rules for measures, for prices, for wages, and fine those who violate the norms. The community is licensed to create a council that will decide that for the sake of the community, this is what people earn. They're entitled to do it, and they can tax the community and say, we are going to act as the clearinghouse to make sure the physicians are paid, and that way everybody will get health care, including those people who couldn't afford to pay what the physicians are going to charge. It's legit. From my understanding, it's legitimate within Jewish tradition to have such a socialized system. Obviously, you have to run it well, and that's hard, but it's legit. Along with this came the question, which, as Jeff noted in his email, was in the Toronto Star this week, a lot of articles recently about it, and the question of publishing the salaries of physicians. Apparently, it's been the practice in some provinces for decades. Ontario is now deciding it or has decided it?
Unclear.
Okay. It passed, but it's unclear. Sorry?
They've done it in the past.
Okay, so they've done it in the past. But it's unclear whether they will do it now. So what do you say regarding publishing physicians' salaries? I'll ask you. Do you think that within Judaism, this is acceptable or not?
They publish the ceiling of each physician, what he can receive. Like a surgeon has to set an amount in the ceiling,
let's ask the question, I guess, differently. Why do we want to publish it? What's the goal of publishing it? I don't think shaming is the reason.
Accountability.
Accountability in what sense?
Where's the public money going in the socialized medical system? Where's the money going to? As far as doctors of private practice, I don't think that they have been publishing their salaries in the past. When you are on salary, however, and the money comes from the Ministry of Health, and they publish, if you're above a certain level, they publish your salary. But it's not just the doctors that they're publishing. They're publishing the salaries of public employees.
Mm-hmm. So what I would say is this. Thank you for the explanation regarding accountability. If you take a look, well, first of all, we have a principle in Judaism that we prohibit what's called rechilut. Rechilut is tale-bearing. Taking information, which is not necessarily negative information, but taking information about a person's life and broadcasting it to other people. It's not allowed. And on very strict terms, on no uncertain terms, we are told that we are not allowed to carry stories about people, positive, negative, doesn't even matter, to other people. And so on that basis, I would say, well then, no, don't publish people's salaries. However, take a look at source number 19 from the Shulchan Aruch regarding tzedakah, another case of communal funds. Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law, says, "Ve'en mechashven b'tzedakah im gabay tzedakah." We don't demand an accounting of tzedakah from the collectors. That's what he writes. However, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, counters and says, "Umikomakom still kedei sheyu nekiyim me'Hashem u'me'Yisrael." In order to fulfill the verse, "You shall be innocent in the eyes of God and Israel." Tov lahem litein cheshbon. It is good for them to present an accounting. And he says, and he says, when the Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, when he wrote that it's good but not required, well, actually, he didn't even say good. When he said we don't demand accounting, he says that's assuming you have collectors who are known and tested and found to be above board. And therefore we trust their administration of the funds. But if these aren't people like that, we don't know their track record, then they're obligated to provide an accounting. And he says the same is true for all communal appointees. So anytime you want to use communal funds, you are required to provide an accounting. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we need to know the names of all the physicians. I could easily envision a simple code set up in someone's database in which each physician's name is correlated with some 8-digit number. And all you publish is the 8-digit number, maybe a description of what they do. You know, they are a fill in the blank, eye doctor, whatever it is, and this is what they make. I don't see why you need, unless you're really into the shaming approach, I don't see why we need everybody to know what the individual person made. You still get your accounting of how the money is being spent without the names attached. Yeah.
In this scenario, is it possible to propose that, for example, there would be some staking audit, but without necessarily all the townspeople knowing every dollar that went into and out of this tzedakah collector's pocket? Because the analogy with medicine would be, you have audit boards, they may not be used very effectively, and they may make a lot of mistakes, but that might be sufficient, and it might not be necessary for every citizen in Ontario. You're delegated to a group that does that, without necessarily violating the privacy of the physicians, which is the countervailing influence. Does it prevent doctors from coming to Ontario to practice if they know that they can be very successful and they'll be on the front page of the Toronto Star every year?
Right. So, yeah, the question is a good question. Can we just have a board that reviews, you know, what's going on? So the answer is yes, as long as they can maintain the confidence of the community. Meaning, in many areas of oversight, we have seen within government, and I don't just mean Ontario now, but just in general, we've seen that if people are sitting on this sort of an oversight committee for a period of years, they get to know each other, they get to know the people who are reporting to them, they start to become lax. They almost feel like they're insulting them by questioning too much, and it becomes a rubber stamp. So you would need safeguards in place to ensure that the public could trust that it's being done properly. But if you could, then I think you satisfy this requirement. People have to have confidence fundamentally that the money that they are now handing over is being used properly. That's the guiding principle. So that concludes this piece of things. We still have the issue of refusing to treat without payment, as well as strikes, and the issue of accepting payment to work on Shabbat. We are also past the 1 hour mark. So that's no good. This isn't going to work. I think what I will have to do is get in touch with the office and the powers that be, which is Jeff, and schedule a part two. We'll probably need another 45 minutes or so, and we'll have a part two, and we'll handle the strikes, the Shabbos payment, and maybe I'll get into the insurance fraud in that session as well. Thank you very much.